Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SuiteOps community, plus a live Q&A that you can't find anywhere else. It's September 20, 2023. My name's Eric Osterman, and I'll be your host. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for startups that helps companies who are overwhelmed with AWS. We do this by leveraging our 200 Terraform modules that have been battle-tested and downloaded over 10 million times. No matter where you find yourself on this journey, we're here to help your startup build a reliable, modern, scalable infrastructure, transform ClickOps into a well-oiled machine, or leverage our open source for rock-solid Terraform blueprints. The results, you launch better products faster, free up your bandwidth for innovation, and nail your value delivery every time. And if you or your team has been bashing your head against the wall with underperforming infrastructure, just head over to cloudposse.com/quiz, answer a few quick questions, and we'll chart a roadmap for success free. Worst case, you get a clear roadmap for shoring up your infrastructure. Best case, we co-build it with you and empower your DevOps team in 90 days or less. So how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format is very informal. Engage as much as you'd like. Ask questions. And if you're curious of any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. For those on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. Join us by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, that's cloudposse.com/office hours. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's office hours valuable, share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse or send us a short testimonial about the value you're getting in Slack just by going to slack.cloudposse.com. Remember, we're not simply creating content here. We're building a vibrant community. Now, let's get the show started with some news. And here is what caught my attention this week. So one thing that blows my mind is still a week later, MGM is suffering from this cyber attack. Now, this is 14 hours later after I wrote this. So it looks like they're saying that most services are back online now or operating normally or so. Well, but they were...
And Caesars also got attacked too at the same time. Yeah. Not just MGM.
Yeah. And it's, and I mean, I know they were being attacked and asked for ransom, but I'm not sure if it's ransomware or that they just crippled the systems by other means and demanded a ransom. Do you know?
Yeah. I, my understanding is they took over the systems. They convinced the help desk that they were administrators. They gave them access to Okta basically. And then once they got into Okta, they like locked other people out and gave themselves access. That's what I'm hearing is was the attack vector in this one.
Social engineering, man. That's the weakest link, humans.
That's why we need to get rid of passwords.
Yeah. Something more is needed for sure.
You said passwords, but you meant humans.
Yes. That's actually ChatGPT's next goal is to eliminate humans. Oh, beware.
One thing I want to just add on the MGM is I heard about the same thing, the social engineering type of attack. But I noticed the other day I got a link, like a bigger company where they ask you to put in your YubiKey. Before they give you any help desk support. So just throwing that out there in case anyone's thinking about how do you prevent that. We're not doing that on my team, but I thought that was a really cool way to, if you have a really large company, thousands of employees, how do you actually know he or she is who they say they are? And I'm like, YubiKey is a great idea, or like some security token.
Yeah.
And before unless you're calling to report that you lost your YubiKey.
Oh, yeah, I don't know how that works.
And it's that other guy you didn't want using it. Yeah. The other one on the security side was trending on Hacker News yesterday. And what caught my attention was that there's a tie-in with this and possibly how Cloud HSM works on AWS. So Cavium, the company, I guess they've been rebranded now, makes the hardware and some, according to Snowden, we all know, he's leaking that there could be a potential backdoor. I don't know if this is, I haven't seen anybody challenge the rumor yet. And if any other devices, for example, Cloud HSM is actually vulnerable to something like this. Anyone have more on this one? Yeah, this was just the...
No. I was going to just comment. I don't have any more on that, but I was going to comment on a comment out there on identity verification. There is a service that I know of that I used to do some work for called Jumio that does like identity based IO, J-U-M-I-O. They actually do like ID based and live. They're the second link. I don't know why they're, that's a different company. Like right the second one, like yeah, Jumio. So Jumio is actually they work with like Clear and a bunch of the other things, like in the airports and all of those, and they have ways that you can tie that into your apps and everything else to do real-time live verification of driver's licenses, facial recognition, a bunch of other things that you know, can identify that you are who you say you are. It's not inexpensive, but you know, there are technologies out there to do it. It's just that implementing it and getting it done is costly and just like not easy to do technologically wise, integrating it everywhere.
Yeah. I do feel something like bio recognition of some form would be a step up.
But or like, you know, even show your ID is hard because even your ID can be stolen. So it has to be like your face. Yeah. So but those then everyone has to be enrolled. Yeah. You know, you have to be enrolled first, and you know, there, but this technology works like super, super well. Like I've used it, it's embedded in a few things that I had to do for some testing. And like I said, I know their technology is what Clear in the airports uses, like under the hood, and some other things. So it's a really good thing to look at for that. But
moving on to the next announcement, I'm sure everyone is tired of all the OpenTF news by now. Lots been going on, but the big news here is that it's officially taken on a new identity. It's called OpenTofu. Lots of references there. It has been overwhelmingly the most popular name that's come up consistently. So tofu is a bland food made of soybean, but it is a base for many other things. It's often a block and it can be built upon. It's also something you can stick a fork into. So there's lots of fun little references to it. I like that it also keeps the same TF reference there. So there's some tie-in to that, unofficially, of course. And the other big news is, of course, that the Linux Foundation has adopted this project. So there's a governance and funding support available through that connection. It's still new and still developing, and it's going to take some time before everything gets ironed out and it operates as a well-oiled machine like many other Linux Foundation projects. But it's on the roadmap, and there's the supporters continue to grow, including large enterprises coming out now, throwing in their support for the project. As part of that, I think we talked about in another office hours that HashiCorp changed the terms of service for the registry that you're only allowed to use it in support of HashiCorp Terraform products. So the registry had to also be reinvented. So this is a stopgap measure, something that was rushed out just to fulfill a requirement of being able to have a registry work with the open or with the tofu CLI. You can actually self-host this, and there is a hosted version. So if you point the registry to registry.opentofu.org. There's no web UI or anything associated. This is strictly like the backend API for it, but that will work with the Tofu CLI. Technically, it should probably also work with the Terraform CLI as well until some sort of backwards compatibility is introduced, or incompatibility is introduced. You can register keys, signing keys for the providers by contributing them into, I forget where exactly it was, into a folder called this. Beyond that, I don't have more information right now. Anyone have anything they can add on the TOFU registry?
I think my biggest question was like, how are they going to get all of the packages like added there?
No, so that's the cool thing is that even in the official registry, none of it is actually hosted by the registry. The registry is basically a glorified redirect proxy, even for the providers. They're just pulling from GitHub. Yeah,
but they still have a source list of all the providers that they need to redirect to. That was my point.
I forget exactly what the solution was for that. It more or less mirrors exactly the GitHub org layout. So organization and repository and whatever other information, and then the tags. That's not a directory in and of itself.
Yeah,
the harder thing to solve was the signing key issue.
Yeah, for sure. And then I assume that there's we need to now publish our Cloud Posse providers, not only to the HashiCorp registry, but also to the OpenTofu registry every time we publish a new version, basically.
That's a good point. I'm not sure to what degree. I don't believe it's I don't believe it's going to function exactly the same way. Oh, I think long as our signing key is in the registry will support any binary that we publish as an artifact to release in our GitHub, I believe. And so long as that signature is validated correctly, it should work. But adding our key though to, you bring up a good point that I haven't looked into how we add our key to that registry yet. I mean, they have instructions there, but I was surprised.
I can take it as a to-do.
Can you take that for us? Exactly. Yeah, let's take that, get that taken care of this week or next. Also, on a related note, all the official, so to say, providers that used to be top level, like HashiCorp providers, also cannot be pulled from their registry. So those republished or syndicated. So those have to be rebuilt. So they've been forked as well. The license of those was never affected by the Boosal change, but the license change the terms of service change rather on the registry did affect them. So those had to be forked and recreated as well. So that's what you see here. The intention is that these will probably not receive pull requests, though I do see that it accepts pull requests here. So we'll bring that up. But yeah, issues have been disabled on that. So, oops. All right. Any other things to bring up before we change topics? All right. Next one is a new project by the company behind Argo CD. So if you've been using Kubernetes, you may be using Argo CD, similar to Flux, with a fancy or prettier UI on top of it. There's some confusion on, why is Cargo needed? Isn't this exactly the same problem that Argo CD was supposed to solve? And Cargo seems to be solving a higher order problem. So with Argo CD, that handles the continuous delivery to your Kubernetes clusters by synchronizing them with a version control system, a VCS. There are lots of reasons you might want to do that. One is it disconnects your CI from your platform. So your CI cannot directly access your Kubernetes cluster. So that's a big win from a security perspective. The other big win is that you have the system of record now, the desired state of your Kubernetes cluster, and it's all in the version control system. So anything you want to affect, any change you want to affect in the cluster has to go through that version control system. And it means that your CI, Kubernetes clusters can be more or less entirely disconnected by direct access from the outside, because they can just be polling the version control system. Now, What if you have lots of environments? You have dev staging production in East Coast, West Coast, Europe, et cetera. How do you handle a coordinated rollout between multiple stages in multiple regions? People have had to come up with this. Various approaches have been taken. You can, you know, use branching strategies to accomplish that. You can use other tooling like, I'm drawing a blank here. The open source alternative to a product like Harness.io, I forget what that, the complicated one, I think it came out of Netflix. Anyways, use other software to do that. So Cargo is, yeah, Spinnaker, thank you, exactly. So Spinnaker is kind of what I believe Cargo is trying to address in a way that fits very well within the Argo project. So with Cargo, which is a cleverly named product, they threw a K in front of Argo, and this is how you can now manage the release process of shipping artifacts between the different stages you have. Matt?
Or can I just, yeah, sorry. I think, AJ, if you can hear us, you have your mic open and there's a lot of background noise coming.
From you.
On the... Yeah, there we go. Thanks. I didn't have control. I couldn't mute them because I'm not an admin.
We got to fix that. Can you?
I'll get it.
Remind me. We'll get that fixed for the next one.
Yeah.
All right. Anything else to add to Argo? Someone looked into this more than I have. All right.
I wonder whether this is, it says brought to you by the creators of the Argo project. I wonder whether they're talking about the creators of Argo before Argo got kind of acquired by like Codefresh and, you know, whoever else who now kind of quote unquote control Argo.
Isn't it in the CNCF? I believe Argo is the CNCF project, exactly. Yeah. So I think Acuity is the company that was behind Argo that donated it to the CNCF.
Okay.
Is, yeah. Check. Anyone know for a fact? Want to confirm it?
I mean, that being a member of, like, being part of CNCF means something, but even something being a part of CNCF, I mean, it still has, you know, whoever is the kind of controlling interest in the product, still that means something too.
Yeah. So this is the story here. So basically, Acuity was founded by Argo CD co-creators Hong Wang and Jesse Xuan and Alexander Matyushenstev. Forgive me for butchering names. That were all founding engineers at Applatics, which open sourced Argo CD. And then after the acquisition by Intuit in 2018, Argo exploded and was later accepted to CNCF. Cool. Let's see here. Next announcement was something. This is interesting. I had to do a double take reading this PR press release. If you just replace the word Urban Code with HashiCorp, you wouldn't be able to almost tell the difference between, like, was this by HashiCorp? Did this predate Terraform by HashiCorp? Differences is, well, they used XML back in the day, go figure, you know, that seemed like that was going to rule the world, especially back in 2012. But otherwise, yeah, it was infrastructure as code to manage EC2 instances and VMware instances and all that. And it was called Terraform with a trademark. Turns out they let the trademark lapse. So that's why HashiCorp can use it. But Terraform that we know was actually meant something else to other people for a long time. And this product still exists today, if I believe correctly. So it's Apache 2. And let me see here. I think it's still receiving So that's 11 years ago. Okay, yeah, no updates in 10 years. So yeah, it, obviously a dormant, dead project, but a bit of history there, right there.
It's interesting that HashiCorp Terraform was released 2 years later.
Exactly. In 2014 was actually when
the initial release.
It also had me scratch my head. Wait, was the, you know, because sometimes these projects are born out of other initiatives, like a project that you had with a customer. And I was almost wondering, wait, could that have been it? But I don't think there's any, there's no such connection. It was shared in our office hour Slack, switching topics. CloudBees announced some large improvements to, I believe, probably Jenkins Enterprise, but it's not clear to me. One of those things is HA, so high availability support within Jenkins. But I just assume this is not available in the open source version. But anyone know more about this announcement?
Yeah, and they don't even call it Jenkins Enterprise. It's CloudBees platform or whatever it's called.
True. Yeah.
It's powered by Jenkins, but it, yeah.
Okay, so you mean, I just kind of took it for granted that if I was using a managed solution, that that would be HA. But so the managed solution is now HA.
Surprised all the people who thought it already was, right? So
yeah, I would have totally taken that for granted. Yeah. All right. Last announcement is somebody mentioned in the office hour Slack channel last week. We missed it, but Rollbar announced a month later that they had a data breach. I'm not entirely sure what the sensitivity or potential impact of this is. Anyone know more about it? All right. That's it for announcements. Does anyone have other announcements that caught their attention over the past week?
There's the big Microsoft Azure, or maybe it's just Microsoft, but the big 38 petabyte, I think it was, data breach.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I'll look up a link.
I saw that.
That's worth mentioning.
This one.
Yeah. Okay, it's terabyte.
38 terabyte.
But it's amazing how Azure just keeps dropping the ball on security. Like it really is questionable, like whether it's a platform to use, just because how can you continue to see breach after breach when it's, yeah.
Almost anyway, 3 years later, it was for people. Discovered by Wiz. Yeah. So was this something basically on Azure's S3 alternative? I forget what they call it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's Azure basically like they had a public bucket.
With a public link. Yeah. And it's always, it's always a contractor.
It's almost as bad as letting your global signing certificate expire and then not being able to use all of your cloud platform because a single certificate expired, which was another Azure outage early on in Azure's lifetime where it was down for several days.
There was one earlier this year where for over a month, like malicious actors, a Chinese hacking group was the expected hacking group, but they had access to US government emails because of a Microsoft Azure exploit. And that was the big one that I was kind of blown away by. But then this came and I was actually giving a talk and had the mention of the US government emails exploit, and then added that 38 terabyte onto the end of my slides, just because it was like, yeah, and even today it's amazing. Look at this.
All right. How did that go, Matt? You were just speaking at some conference in Denver where you're based, right?
Yeah. Super simple. It was like cloud one-on-one stuff people who don't know anything about the cloud. Nothing that folks would be interested in here, okay. But it was good. Yeah. Can't complain.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, let's jump into Q&A then, if there are no other announcements. I see David has a question in the Zoom chat here. Let's check into that. So David asks a question for today, if there's time. I've been looking into using Terraform with drift detection via Spacelift to manage security relevant stuff and share visibility with InfoSec. So group membership, security rules, et cetera. But there's a hole around memberships and possibly rules added manually that aren't in state so they don't get spotted as drift. Is there any clever way to catch these? Are you talking about policies that you're using with Spacelift and those aren't being caught with a drift detection?
No, not policies, just okay. Like normal kind of the list of memberships on an Azure group or or the list of rules against the security. Because I think if you add a thing on the end, because it wasn't created by Terraform, it won't spot it as drift. If you take one off,
So Spacelift drift detection, Terraform Cloud drift detection, pretty much almost every other provider out there drift detection is based on drift of Terraform state, not a comparison of what's been deployed in the relevant account or subscription to your infrastructure's code. Hey, it looks good, Dave. What you eating?
Macro, man.
Nice. So in this case, it sounds like your group memberships and security rules aren't managed with infrastructure as code. So therefore, yes, Spacelift will not detect any drift there.
Yeah, I mean, they are managed, or they will be, if this all goes through, managed with infrastructure as code. The hole I'd like to close is, I want to be able to say to InfoSec, hey, if somebody goes in fast with these manually, you'll see drift. Mm-hmm. So far, I can't see that. And I can imagine writing a null resource that goes and, for the groups, goes and queries the APIs and, compares the length or compares the content or whatever. That feels a bit rubbish. I wondered if he's done anything better than that.
Matt, are you interpreting this different than I am?
No, I think I understand what David's saying. Basically, he's saying if he has, like, let's just say, a group or a role or something, that they create, but someone manually goes into the console and creates a new group or creates a new role.
Yeah.
There's no way for Terraform to tell that there's this other thing out there, like that doesn't exist, that's like outside of the bounds of what was created with IEC. So you can't figure out how to help make Terraform help them with that. That problem, which I don't think it can.
The answer here is to make it so that no one is capable of changing the environment unless it's come through Spacelift or whatever. That's a pain in the ass because people are used to having access, but. One of the kind of core tenets of continuous delivery is one path to production and only one path to production. typical patterns are like have a break glass account or a couple of break glass accounts with all kinds of, alarm bells on them. If anybody uses them, it immediately sends out a notification say, hey, somebody used the break glass account, which needs to happen sometimes. And then the only other thing was like, you could do something like Cloud Custodian where it'll just watch your account and, whatever patterns you set up, like, hey, if a bucket's created that doesn't have, this tag on it, just automatically delete it.
Yeah. I guess I totally agree with all that. I'm trying to close the fact that we have to have super admins who can break glass. And sure, you can catch the notifications and all that kind of stuff, but that's a lot of that's a pretty complex way around and requires a lot of constraints. Whereas saying, "Hey, these are managed with this," I think I'm asking something of Terraform it can't do. I just wondered whether because there's loads of cool you know, add this thing to TF and add this thing to TF. I mean, Atmos itself adds stacks of stuff to TF that it doesn't sort of natively do. I just wondered whether anybody had a cool app, but it's not a big deal.
No, there. I mean, there's an ambitious project that tried to do this specifically for certain clouds, but it's not a catch-all, and that's the tool I'm talking about is Drift CTL, and it's not. I don't know if it's really up to the job of doing it the way you want to do it necessarily as well. It will miscategorize things as well as drifting, even though it is in the code. I think it's gotten better at it.
For non-malicious cases, tagging your resources is really handy, right? So anything that's created infrastructure as code probably has a standard set of labels. You may want to expand that. I use one called managed by, and if it says managed by, it says ClickOps or Terraform. And so that's for non-malicious, is using tagging strategies besides using like Drift Control, as Eric said, or Terraformer, or some of the other tools that are available. There's a few. Terraformer is one of them that will rip through the cloud account and create resources based on what it sees there. And so you can abuse that to do a pro forma audit.
Abuse being the keyword.
Yeah, I was actually going to suggest, if you really wanted a Terraform solution for your specific use case, what you probably could do is write a Terraform module that uses data sources to look up all of the IAM roles that were provisioned with Terraform from state, look up all of the IAM roles that exist in an account, and then compare the list and output the differences. And then you could do that again for user groups, user account, you know, whatever you need to do that. You could definitely force Terraform to be your tool to do this, but you would need to write a couple modules to make it happen. But it would be possible to do it that way.
But yeah, that's the provider's a better option than the null module, which is the only other thing I could, the null resource, which is the only other thing I'd thought of. But yeah, that's definitely better.
Yeah.
Thanks all.
Next question here I see is from Blaze. Anyone have any experience or opinion on crates? What is this here? Blaze, you want to introduce it?
Python. Yeah, it's like a Python module. I just found out about it a few days ago, and I'm in the midst of studying for my CKA, so I'm kind of, you know, got my eyes open for cool things like this. It seems like it's a Python module to be able to interact with a Kubernetes cluster, built along the lines of like kubectl. So like one of the example projects buried in is a kind of a next gen kubectl, kind of like K9s but written in Python. So I was just wondering if anybody had already messed around with it at all.
I saw it trending on Reddit, but it didn't kind of stand out to me.
I have taken a look at it. So the options here would be something like the native Python libraries, or we have tools that basically run kube control, get JSON or YAML output, and then parse that. This library actually looks pretty nice. It does caching of the API responses, and it has a pretty straightforward way of getting at the node or pod or what have you attributes. So it looks very promising to me. The problem with a lot of this automation is that the API for Kubernetes is very low level. So when we want to see, for example, a node, we'd like to know things like how much memory does it have, or how was it allocated, or so on. And that information is very often sliced and diced among labels, attributes, conditions, statuses, metadata. There are like six or seven different zones of activity in Kubernetes where that information may be stored. As far as I have been able to determine, whether it's the standard library, whether it's kubectl control, getting the output and parsing it, whether it's crates here. None of them really abstract at that level. So if a node is allocated via Fargate or managed node group or by Carpenter, you as a automation author have to pretty much know where to look, even with these APIs. So I would say promising, but the concepts of that you really want from an operator point of view are very much buried in, you know, the eight different slices of life that the Kubernetes API exposes, and these do not themselves up-level that. Mm. So most of the, like, if you look at a cloud API like Boto 3, almost all of them have a low-level view and then a high-level view.
Yeah.
You know, an under half and an upper half. True of all the ORMs as well. You can think of all the libraries, including crates, as being the lower half. Of the API. This seems like a nice lower half of the API, but it's still, your code still has to have a lot of skill at knowing to look in the labels as opposed to the annotations, as opposed to the metadata, as opposed to the statuses.
Thanks. That's actually a beautifully coherent summary.
Yeah, we're lucky to have you on the call, gentlemen, today. Yeah. Any other questions we can get answered today?
Yes, I've got a question.
Go for it.
I'm curious what people's experiences have been with service meshes. And follow up to that is, at what level of microservice complexity do you think you can start to benefit from that?
I'm happy to chime in, but I want to let others go first.
I have a great answer for this. Service meshes are awesome, and any level of complexity benefits from them. Here's why. When you put something in that sits in front of your app, you're able to have it do things that your app would normally be responsible for doing. So if you have compliance requirements for your app has to do logging in this way, it's got to use TLS, you know, and whatever, you can just tell your app developing team, you know, we take care of all that. You don't have to worry about it. We do, you know, we automatically log all your stuff where it needs to go. All you have to do is make sure you're logging to standard out. And we, you know, we take care of the mutual TLS, you know, and all the communication with, you know, the outside world, with other stuff in the cluster. And you don't have to worry about any of that. Platform handles it all for you.
So I think what Andrew brings up is all accurate from that perspective. I think it comes down to roles and responsibilities. When you are just the consumer of a well-managed, well-oiled Kubernetes cluster and all of that, or I'm assuming Kubernetes, but it could be anything else, you know, with a mesh in place, I think it makes a lot of things better. Where I've seen companies struggle firsthandedly is if they adopt it too quickly before they are, you know, really adept at operating Kubernetes itself and all the intricacies therein. Meshes also have evolved a great deal. So maybe doing it, you know, now in 2023, it's a lot easier. We'll follow on that with something else. But previously, like upgrading Istio was not a walk in the park, and it's an operator. Read into upgrading operators on Kubernetes. It's basically upgrading thing. Is that basically cowboy coding in production when you upgrade operators? Frequently, you have to uninstall it to reinstall it, and you can have all kinds of things go nuts with the mesh then. Now, things have come a long ways. There's like 10 different 15 different, not counting commercial, there's probably like 100 different meshes out there. I mean, every enterprise security product has them, but Istio is obviously the winner. Now Kubernetes has come out with first-class support for sidecars that can start before your services start. So one of the biggest problems with meshes has been that if the mesh, if the init, basically if your sidecar container didn't start at the right time, your app was without a network, and that caused race conditions on that side of things working. It's also doubling your resources for, to some degree, because you're deploying this extra container for every single service that you want deployed. So it has networking capabilities. So it, that this is where, like, on the operator side of things, I don't love it. We don't recommend it to customers, the same kind of customer who reaches out to Cloud Posse and wants to set up their Kubernetes cluster and do all of that is also not the same kind of customer that's ready to, I think, operate Kubernetes at that level and introduce the mesh. Where do I see things going from here? And is the mesh still a first class? I was going to say primitive, but it's not a primitive, but a first class thing to include with your Kubernetes cluster. I'm most excited personally about Lattice, which is an overlay network managed by AWS. Now, this is an AWS specific solution, but I, you know, AWS leads and other clouds shall follow. And this is this idea where, yeah, go on, Matt.
I was going to say, but AWS actually has service mesh too, which is actually a service mesh. Right.
But AWS has like 1,000 competing services. It's an exaggeration here, but they have lots of competing services that have overlapping concerns. And AWS Service Mesh is one that I've never seen AWS App Mesh is not something that I've seen really get off the ground or get going. I feel like where AWS is likely to invest, continue to invest considerably, is in the whole Lattice model. And then they have an operator for Lattice, and that's basically a fully managed mesh, or like a mesh, an overlay network for Kubernetes. And every other AWS service.
I guess the one, that would be my one argument about like App Mesh and other tools like Lattice as they do evolve, I guess, is it's all those things that you talked about, the upgrades and the complexity of running it and all that is completely abstracted from you. And you basically just run the client like sidecar, like you run Envoy proxy and, you know, in your Kubernetes cluster and you're done. And you can also participate in the service mesh off of the cluster too, right? So in EC2 instances and with Lambdas and other things out there. So,
I have a tangential question off of this, which was kind of a blocker for me to try and adopt service meshes, but I'll kind of throw it out there and see if maybe folks have any advice. So one of the reasons we were hesitant with service mesh, and mainly the reason why we would be interested would be kind of the like blue green or canary deployment kind of approach. And the reason why is, you know, specific to our use case, we're running Django and Django Celery for worker-related async tasks. And so what we're thinking is, because the code related to the worker has a hard coupling to the front-end code, right, where the request would be coming in to make the async Celery request, one thing that we were concerned about is if we have a canary deployment for the front end web container, and then the worker is also being spun up with new Celery code, you can run into a situation where you have two versions of your worker code listening on the same message broker. And so messages being processed by the worker can be unintentionally and confusingly processing the message in a way that is not what you expect or intend to be. Does that make sense? And I can kind of clarify it a bit more. But how do people handle this structure where you have your front end code where you want to do blue green, but then your workers are kind of tied and bound together?
Well, so the actual messages themselves should have like this, like should have schema versions that are like encoded into the messages. And if something picks up a message that it doesn't have the capability to process that schema version, it basically should abort and put it back on the queue, or you know, let the queue timeout happen again so a different worker picks it up that has the right schema version to be able to pick it up. That's usually how like large enterprises deal with multiple versions of those kinds of things.
Yeah,
I think that's more like application architecture than it is service mesh, though. Like, because you have the same problem even if you weren't using a service mesh, you would have that same problem if you were doing any kind of blue-green deployment.
Exactly. Which is why potential question.
Let's Isaac speak up. I think he was the one who asked the question originally.
Right. Yeah. I wanted to ask a follow-up about that. So I've heard from someone who was very positive on service meshes, and I've heard from you who says you kind of discourage teams away from it. I'm curious, for you, Andrew, how big is your team that was responsible for setting up and managing the service mesh is? The reason why I'm asking this is that I'm getting some sort of suggestion to implement a service mesh. Now, me a year ago would have been very excited to play with this new technology and just go bonkers with it. But I've come to realize as a person managing a DevOps team that signing up for anything should be a very measured decision, because and my team have to support it when it goes wrong. And so that's what I'm trying to understand here. What is the possible really bad things that can happen? And then I'll be on the hook to say, why didn't you push back? Because as far as I understand from everything I've read, you know, the most popular service mesh out there is Istio. And it's apparently a bear to diagnose when there's issues in your cluster. It's also a bear to upgrade. So I'm like trying to understand, what am I signing my team up for? And I feel like I'm not at the scale where I need this. If I'm just running about 30 microservices, all the companies that seem to be big into service mesh, like really huge companies with thousands of microservices. And so that's the point of view where I'm coming from, but I didn't want to front load this so that I don't bias the responses, but if someone can comment on that.
I think it's, so I will start by agreeing with Eric in cases where it's like you've just got the one team, you know, deploying the cluster and running stuff on top of it. It's probably, you know, my situation is that I'm on a platform team. I run the platform, and then app teams come in and use the platform. So you said 30 microservices. I wonder how many teams it is that is developing 30 microservices.
Just two teams.
Two teams are running 30 microservices. So, I mean, that's probably in the gray area, you know, but like I see huge benefit of it for the application teams that I support, because they don't have to worry about all that compliance junk. We just take care of it. They just write their application. Doesn't matter what language it is, doesn't matter, you know, they don't need to know about Splunk. You know, we're required to ship all our logs to Splunk. They don't have to care about any of that, you know, because we just do it all for them. They just come with their application. You know, that's very beneficial. And if you had, like, if you're managing the Kubernetes cluster for everybody, if your team is, and there are other teams coming in to use the cluster, then you're starting to get into that situation. Two teams managing, or two teams, you know, involved here is, I don't know, we have more than that. We have more than two teams, but I don't know, like look, think through how much time each of those teams are having to spend with any kind of, you know, okay, here's the requirements. You have to output your logs as JSON, and they have to have these particular keys, and, you know, you have to, you know, output your metrics in this way. And it's like the platform can handle all of that. And the service mesh is a big part of that.
I guess I'm a bit confused as to why does service mesh seem to indicate whether a platform has the ability to standardize output logs or metrics? Isn't that just the networking layer between the pods itself? Like if you just deploy your container with the service, and some generic ingress, is that not sufficient? Where does, what additional logging or metrics or capabilities gets exposed as part of a Istio service mesh, for example?
I mean, I think there's a whole long list of things that can come from it, like traffic policies, mutual TLS authentication, end-to-end TLS communication, blue-green deployments, like you said, better observability of and comparing like blue versus green in your traffic patterns. There's like a million things that come from it. And all of what you just said can be done. I mean, all of the things we could do without a tool like that. But I think the idea of a service mesh is that you just write your app, you log to standard out, and then the service mesh can actually take care of doing the heavy lifting of shipping the Splunk in this example that we were just using. And your developer has to have no idea that that's actually happening under the hood. Where if you don't do that, your developer has to be like,